it's so easy to say no to things because they might be a little difficult or they might be a little scary. But then how do you ever find out what you're good at, what you're passionate about, you know? And I am so grateful that when I made partner at a public accounting firm that I didn't just say, well, that's it. That's it. I made partner. I don't need to try things. It was after I made partner that I tried publishing. It was after I made partner that I started teaching. And it's been the most fulfilling years of my career.
Welcome back, friends. This is Future Proof. I am your host, Bill Sheridan. So let's talk about your career path. If you're new to the profession, and even if you're not, I'm not going to lie to you, things are going to get weird, okay? It's just the nature of work today. Things are changing at an exponential pace these days, and that means your career is going to change exponentially too. And that means you've got to be ready, right? With new skills, a flexible career path, the ability to shift on a dime when the time comes. More than ever, we all have to be more nimble, more flexible, more willing to learn new skills. Our careers, our futures, and those of our customers or clients depend on it now more than ever. And I'm going to explain why here in just a second. First, let me start with the fact that this week's show is sponsored by the Business Learning Institute, which delivers competency-based curriculum, courses, content, and community to maximize career trajectories and grow intellectual capital for organizational and executive leadership. Hundreds of courses by dozens of instructors and unlimited customization. Find out how the Business Learning Institute can help you by visiting blionline.org. Okay, so your career path. Like I said, it's going to get crazy. There's no getting around it. You'll need to prepare yourself for a career that takes many, many twists and turns. And believe me, I know what I'm talking about here. There's not a whole lot you can do about it either, but there are some things you can do to prepare yourself for those twists and turns. And there's no shortage of people out there ready to offer you advice. Just Google career advice for new graduates. No, really, go ahead and Google it. I'll wait. See what I mean? Tons of really solid career advice for an age of complexity and uncertainty. Here's some that I particularly like. It comes in the form of a blog post written a few years back by my colleague, Rebecca Brown. Here's what she says. She says, quote, "The typical career path isn't a nice, well-lit, straight, flat street. It's more like Lombard Street in San Francisco in the dark," end quote. And if you're not familiar with Lombard Street, it has a reputation as the most crooked street in the world. The 1,000 block of Lombard Street has 8 sharp turns, which are actually a necessity, Rebecca says, to reduce the hill's natural 27% grade, which is too steep for most vehicles. And actually, a little side trivia here, not only is Lombard Street not the most crooked street in the world, it's not even the most crooked street in San Francisco. That title goes to Vermont Street between 20th and 22nd streets. But I digress. Your career. It's like Lombard and Vermont streets. You can't get to your final destination in a straight line. You'll end up careening out of control. You need to build in a series of twists and turns that'll help you remain relevant in a changing and complex world. And Rebecca offers a few bits of advice. First, make contacts, with social media being a great tool to put you in contact with thought leaders and mentors who can help you take your career to the next level. Next, learn new skills. Nothing is more important given the pace of change today, rather. I always love to quote Fast Company editor Robert Safian, who said that the most important skill we must master going forward is the ability to learn new skills. And that's so true. And Rebecca's final bit of advice, learn the real you. She recommends that new graduates take a strengths assessment like StrengthsFinder 2.0 or the VIA or VIA survey of character strengths to understand more about yourself and the type of career and life you're suited for. And more than that, you have to stay true to what you're passionate about, right? In Simon Sinek's terms, you need to identify your why. Why do you do what you do? Figure that out and almost everything else falls into place. And that brings me to my guest this week. And truly, I'm not sure I've ever had a guest who's had as inspiring a message about the twists and turns of career and life as this week's guest. He's Tony Needy. Tony is a partner in Reuben Brown's Tax Services Group. He's also a well-known contributor of tax content to Forbes and a frequent speaker and trainer at seminars and webcasts across the country. What's clear when you talk to him, though, is that he's just a guy trying to figure out his way in the world, but his journey has been amazing, and it's something I think that all of us can learn from. And rather than expand on that, I'm just going to let Tony tell his story. Please listen, because this interview has more lessons embedded in it than I think any other interview I've done. I mean, Tony's journey, it's our journey. And learn from what he's done. Apply it to your own journey, because this is amazing stuff. Trust me on this. Just sit back and take it all in for the next hour or so. The kicker at the end is worth its weight in gold, and it's so worth the wait. So here's a look at our future-ready career journey with Tony Needy. Well, let's just start with a little of your origin story. Where are you from originally?
Grew up in New Jersey.
New Jersey.
Yeah, okay. Grew up in New Jersey. I actually went to college about a mile from my home at the College of New Jersey. So, but you know, 22 years old, I really never ventured out of central New Jersey.
Uh-huh.
That has changed.
Yeah, dramatically from what I hear. Why accounting? What drew you to the profession?
Well, look, right? If I was in a room with 100 people and asked show of hands how many grew up dreaming of being accountants, you're not going to see a whole lot of hands.
Yeah, right.
And I wasn't one of those either, right? I mean, the only thing I can remember being passionate about growing up was writing. You know, I loved to read, but more importantly, I loved to write. But when I got to college, you know, you just kind of think, hey, a journalism degree is a one-way ticket to the homeless shelter. You know,
right.
And particularly, you know, if you're self-aware enough to know that you might enjoy it and be decent at it, but you're not good enough to carve out a living. And so I went into college undecided. I was playing soccer at college. That was my priority. And I just thought, since I don't know what I'm going to do, I should extend that uncertainty as long as possible. So I started thinking about law school.
Okay.
And one of my college teammates said to me, well, if you want to go to law school, you know, don't just be another run-of-the-mill criminal justice majors. All the law schools are looking for accounting majors now.
No kidding.
And so, completely serious, that's how I ended up an accounting major. It's never something I had thought about or was passionate about, but I thought it was the best way to get into the law school of my choice. And so, started majoring in accounting.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not like it clicked and I was like, this is the fit for me. I still thought I was going to go to law school, but when I graduated, the Big Four came to campus and did interviews, and Arthur Anderson made me an offer. And, you know, at 22 years old, you're doing the cost-benefit analysis versus taking on loans to go to law school versus what Arthur Anderson back in 1998 was offering a new hire, which sounded like a lot of money, but
right.
Obviously, you know, you find out pretty quickly it's not. But still, it's just that's how I ended up launching my career, really, with still no degree of certainty that accounting was even right for me.
So this, you know, this was 98 we're talking about.
98.
Yep. Okay. This path of yours has kind of taken you in a lot of different directions and had you trying a lot of interesting things, at least for you know, people who have been in this profession for a
sure.
long time. Tell me a little bit about where it's where it's taken you at this point.
So Anderson makes me an offer, and just kind of like flip of the coin, I go tax, right? I don't know really any difference between tax and audit, but what I've always kind of, my life's, you know, like most people's life, it's always been kind of shrouded in uncertainty. I mean, what do we ever really know about ourselves as far as what we want to do in life? So I've always tried to cling to the few things I knew that were non-negotiable,
right?
And professionally, the one thing I knew would be non-negotiable was there had to be constant challenge, constant intellectual stimulation. And I felt like the tax law would probably be a good source of that constant challenge, you know, because it's just, there's never going to be that moment where you close the cover to the code and that's it.
We're
I got
done.
It. Figured it all out.
We're
you
done.
Know? And so I thought that was a good choice. So I got hired by Anderson. I flipped the coin, went into tax, but, you know, just twist of fate. I get hired to start the following September, but I graduated in December. They wanted all their new hires to start on the same day, right? That was like a big Anderson thing. You foster competitiveness between
okay.
it. So they told me like, hey, just take 6 months and go enjoy yourself, study for the CPA exam. And as I just said to you, you know, I grew up in New Jersey. I went to school in New Jersey. And the thing I had grown passionate about as my soccer career winding down was skiing. And so I moved up to Sugarbush, Vermont for those 6 months and just kind of worked as a ski bum for a year and literally, you know, woke up every day and didn't need a snow report to tell me how much it snowed. I just looked out my window, you know, and every day I'd go out and make some turns and just lived a simple life. And that layered on another thing in my life that was going to become non-negotiable. I knew that somehow, some way, I was going to end up living in a mountain town, you know, somewhere where, like I said, the things I was really passionate about would be just a stone's throw away, so that if I was in a career with a ton of intellectual stimulation and therefore required a lot of work, that was fine. But when I wasn't working, the things that, you know, really kind of made my soul flourish, I guess, for lack of a better term, were right there.
That had to be right. That had to be close by. Mm-hmm.
But, right, that was kind of a tough thing to swallow, because now living in the mountains is non-negotiable, and I was about to start a career in Arthur Anderson in September in, you know, northern New Jersey and Manhattan.
And this was before remote work became a thing.
Gosh, you know? And, you know, I went from, you know, skiing 100 days that year when I was off to starting at Anderson and getting thrown right into the fire and, you know, fostering that competitive behavior between new staff. It really works. We were all trying to outdo each other with, you know, how many hours we worked, how well we could do in the CPA exam. And after a year of my life at Anderson, I looked up and the year had gone exceedingly well. You know, I was well thought of at the firm and I had knocked out the exam in one shot and things were going okay. But I looked up and I was like, what did I do other than work? Like, I never saw snow. I never went on skis, you know? And I just kind of thought, I don't know, maybe it's supposed to be this way. Maybe you're supposed to pay your dues and just suck it up. Boy, it doesn't feel right. You know, like there's other ways to live life. And what I found myself doing that first year was constantly wishing time away. You know, like I wish it were April 15th so I could get a break. And then I wish it were October 15th so I could get a break. Or I wish it were 11:30 at night so I could go home. And it's just a dangerous way to live.
We all do that too.
We do.
You know? I mean, over and over again, I catch myself doing it and think, you know what? You only got so much time, man.
Well, as we'll get to, I'm sure that's a lesson I learned the hard way about a decade later, that, you know, none of us are promised tomorrow. And so I was getting desperate and I was sending resumes to like every ski resort in America, which it's just kind of idiotic because I'd started a career with a fantastic firm. I was enjoying what I was doing. I loved the challenge of the tax law, but I just wasn't happy with the rest of my life. And, I just kind of felt like, you know, I could wait until I'm old and retired and then move to a mountain town, or I could take advantage of the fact that I work for the biggest firm in the world at what I do that has, you know, locations in every major city in America. And so I walked in, I'll never forget it, after a year at Anderson, I walked into our HR person's office and gave this, you know, impassioned, compelling speech about all the reasons I needed to transfer to the Denver office and just left out of it one little fact, which is, I'd never actually been to Colorado, you know, but they rolled the dice and they let me go out there and interview, and the interview went great. And so after a year, I packed up and moved to Denver. And like I said, you know, I'd never left New Jersey at that point. So it was a big deal for me. It was a big deal for my family, but you know, I just went out there, no friends, you know, no real contacts, but just said, hey, I'm going to make a go of this. Worst thing can happen is I'll just come home, you know?
Right.
And so it, 23, I transferred to Anderson, Denver. And, you know, I quickly discovered that my issues with my time at Anderson weren't so much geography based as culturally based, because I was working just as many crazy hours in Denver. And in a lot of ways, it was more frustrating there because I could look out the window of the office and see everything I wanted to do.
Right.
But I couldn't touch it, you know? And you wanted to like kind of shake everybody you work with and go, don't you understand? Like there's adventure right outside the window. Let's go do this thing.
Right.
And so needless to say, I was not long for Anderson. And so a year later, so now we're talking 2000, I moved just down the road in Denver and went over to PricewaterhouseCoopers.
So that was fortuitous.
Because you've got the dates working in your head and you know what happens soon after.
2000 and Anderson.
Yeah.
That's, we're getting close there. So
really close. Mm-hmm. So, you know, another year after I had left Anderson, it ceased to be, as you said, is pretty fortuitous. But obviously I had no idea any of those things were going on. But just another lesson in life that, you know, you, wherever you are in your career, have to have substance. You have to have skills that are transferable. You can have your ultimate allegiance be to your firm and your partners and your client, and that's fine. But who knew? Like, who knew Anderson would be wiped off the face of the earth? All of a sudden, all those people had to go find jobs. And so, you know, if you were one of the ones that built up substance and you were going to be in luck, but if you were the one that just was solely worried about placating that one manager or one partner at Anderson and hadn't actually, you know, built any skills, you know, becomes tricky.
Yep. Yep.
So I'm over at PW now and
still in Denver?
Still in Denver. And I'm getting for the first time that taste of work-life balance. There was a better culture there. And so you know, I'm getting to ski a bit more, I'm getting mountain bike a bit more. I'm really happy personally and professionally. And my career starts taking off. And after 2 years at PW, so four total years of my career now, I get promoted to manager. And this will always be the seminal moment in my career because I get promoted to manager on the tax side. And, you know, people around me are congratulating me and saying, oh, you can write your own ticket now, manager at the Big Four. You can go do this and do that and go into private. And, you know, world is your oyster. And I just remember being overwhelmed with fear because I realized that, I just got promoted to manager. And I don't actually know anything about the tax law because I had spent those 2 years running big projects, you know, huge consolidated returns, like just organizing them, getting people to work on them, meeting deadlines. But at no point had my personal growth kind of taken precedent where, you know, I said, why am I doing what I'm doing? You know, what is the law that compels me to do all of these things? And so when I saw manager go on my resume, I always use this word, and some people think I'm being harsh on myself, but it's 100% true. I just felt like a fraud because now I had this resume that was getting more impressive, but I didn't feel like I had the knowledge base to support that resume. And it was terrifying because instead of feeling like I could go anywhere or do anything, I felt the exact opposite. I felt like a prisoner to PwC because they knew me. They knew my shortcomings. They knew what I did well. And as long as I kept doing what I did, they would eventually, you know, keep promoting me, you know, you would think. But like I had learned with Anderson disappearing, you know, okay, that's fine if I wanted to spend the rest of my career at PW. But what if I wanted to move somewhere else or go somewhere else, try something different? Like I had no substance and it was terrifying because I could go to an interview and I could BS my way through it and get my foot in the door. But it wasn't going to take a new firm long to realize that I didn't have any real knowledge. And they would have a set of expectations. Oh, you're a manager at PW. You must know this, this, and this, and be able to do this, this, and this. And I didn't. I couldn't do it. You know?
Do you really think, I mean, do you think there was a touch of like imposter syndrome in there? Or not a touch.
Yeah, this was overwhelming. And it was real.
But I mean, you know, with a lot of folks who say, oh, I'm not good enough for this, it's just them convincing themselves that they're not, when in fact that they might actually, but you're saying I just didn't know what I needed to know at that point.
The only way I can describe it, Bill, is I really do mean this. Like throughout my career, I've tried hard not to measure myself based on, you know, my evaluations or my pay raise or my title, but rather when I look in the mirror at night, like, am I comfortable with what I know and what I can do relative to other people my age around the country? Mm-hmm. And at that point in time, I knew that people around me were getting masters in tax and you know, they had spent years on the consulting side. And me, I was just helping people crank out small pieces of a big consolidated return. Like I wasn't even getting to see the end product, you know what I mean? And so I think the imposter syndrome was a very, very real affliction at that time because I really did not have a deeper understanding of the tax law, and that was going to be extremely limiting in my career. And so when I say it was a seminal moment, it was the moment I drew a line in the sand and said, look, I can keep doing what I'm doing here. And PwC will keep feeding me these big returns because I've shown that I can organize them and get them done. But I'm just going to dig a deeper hole with this imposter syndrome and never be able to make up the gap that currently exists between what my resume says I can do and what I can really do. And so that was when I made the decision that just changed everything for me and just said, look, you know, I don't care if this ends up kind of hurting me a little bit at work or not, but if I'm not getting what I need, if I'm going to stay in the tax world, in my mind, to be the best tax person I can be, I'm going to build my career on a technical foundation. I'm going to understand the law. And if I'm not going to get that law here at my job, then I'm going to start supplementing my job. And so I, you know, applied to go to graduate school at University of Denver's master's in tax, the graduate tax program, which is one of the best in the country. And I said, you know, for the first time in my life, this isn't high school or college where I'm going to school because it's expected of me. Like, I'm going because I need to go. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. So I just went in and soaked up everything I could. I mean, you know, sat in the front row of class, did all the required reading, asked all the questions. I mean, just that guy, and just said, I am here to learn as much as possible.
Yeah, yeah. That's awesome.
And, you know, what happened was I didn't have to wait long to see that investment in myself be rewarded, because my first two classes at DU, the professor, unbeknownst to me, I didn't even know, ran the entire program. Hmm. And I didn't think he noticed me from anyone else in the class. You know, I mean, it was obvious that I cared, because again, I was kind of asking a lot of questions and doing the work. But one day out of the blue, after my second class, and I was taking, you know, one class a semester, so this master's was going to come in on a slow boat. It was going to take 5 or 6 years. Right. And the phone call that changed my life was he called my office at PwC and he said, look, it's really obvious that you're invested in this program, that you care about this stuff. And that is unique even for people seeking a master's degree. Mm-hmm. So he said, I know you're going part-time. I assume it's because PwC is reimbursing you. But if you ever want to not go part-time, come talk to me and I'll take care of you. And I said, well, what do you mean take care of me? And he's like, you can go to school here for free. And I was like, sign me up, right? Sign me up. And because what I saw now was a quicker path mm-hmm. to where I wanted to be, and that where I wanted to be was to be able to look in the mirror at the end of the night and not feel like a fraud, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so PwC was awesome. They gave me a leave of absence for a year, and I enrolled full-time in the program, and it was heaven, you know, because for the first time in my career, and keep in mind, I had worked at Anderson and PwC, so there were some very impressive partners I worked with. I mean, huge salaries and big homes and great reputations, but being in the master's program and looking at these professors who could recite 50-year-old case law off the top of their head or, you know, obscure revenue rulings, it was the first time that I looked at somebody within our industry and said, that's what I want to be able to do. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what I want my career to be. I want to be an expert. I want to have that level of substance. And it doesn't mean it's you know, a wrong career path if that's not what you're after, if you want to build your career on building a book of business or, you know, whatever it may be. But for me, that's what lit the fire.
Yeah.
So I was like, I want to be able to do that. I want to be able to command respect to my peers and learn the law as much as possible and then use that to service clients and provide a ton of value. And so for that year, you know, just kind of soaked everything up and it just changed everything because, you know, 1 year after feeling like a total imposter, I emerged from that program going, you know what, I'll throw my hat in the ring from a technical perspective with any other, at that point, 27-year-old in America, you know, mm-hmm. and that kind of, again, inspired me to say, wherever I go, whatever I do with my career from this point on, it's going to be built, like I said, on a foundation of the actual tax law itself and understanding what it has to mm-hmm. say.
So you got your master's. And then what? Now, what's next for you at that point?
It's just so weird how this stuff all works, right? Because why did I tell you, like, I was adamant about going back to get the master's? And why was I adamant about, you know, taking advantage of that full-time opportunity? Because don't get me wrong, he was paying for my education, but it's still a kick in the butt when you're 26 to stop getting paid at your job sure. and go back to school. I mean, there's still living expenses.
Right.
But I wanted to do it because, again, you know, I was 26, I was single, I was 2,000 miles from my family. You don't feel a sense of, you know, permanence and stability at that point. You feel like life could move in a million different directions. And I just thought if it moved in a different direction, I needed substance. I needed to be able to walk into an interview somewhere and feel good about myself. And lo and behold, while I'm in graduate school, I go back to New Jersey for Christmas, and at a Christmas party, and a girl walks in, and you know, we had kind of grown up together but didn't know each other. And pretty soon after that, realized my plans are about to change. You know, I'm moving back to New Jersey, and this is the girl I'm going to marry. And so when I emerged from the graduate program, I didn't go back to PricewaterhouseCoopers. You know, I mean, it was, hey, I'm done. Thank you for everything, obviously, but I'm moving back to New Jersey. And so, I mean, you talk about a reward. You know, I go back to New Jersey and I interview with Withum Smith and Brown at the time. And at that point thought, well, I'm just going to do what people do, right? Like now that I know I'm getting married and going to start a family, like I'm going to do it around our family, even though, again, I was forsaking what I had learned, which is that being like in a mountain town and that was non-negotiable to me. I just thought, hey, the family lore will be enough to, you know, kind of compensate for that. And so I interviewed it with him, feeling great about my technical ability. And I got hired, you know, working at Withum Smith & Brown in Princeton, New Jersey. And it's funny because I ended up with him for almost 15 years. And most people don't realize that I was ever actually in New Jersey because I didn't stay there long, but yeah. I was actually in the New Jersey office when I started my career at Withum. And so, you know, I started it with him and I was adamant not to let what I had just learned in grad school slip away, because it can slip away quick, you know? And luckily, you know, the people I worked with at Withum saw that I cared about the research side and the tax law side, and they kind of, you know, encouraged me to take on almost like a poor man's national tax role and address a lot of the big issues. And, you know, I was just diving into everything. And the term I use when people ask me to kind of speak about my career path is I just made the decision then that, look, I love PwC. I certainly was starting to love Withum, but ultimately I was always going to make sure I invested in myself, because again, you didn't know where life was going to lead, you know? And I'm not going to lie to you. When I pulled up that first day back in New Jersey for work, you know, after battling traffic, it took me an hour to go 13 miles. I had a sneaking suspicion that I was not long for New Jersey.
Right.
And keep in mind, this is 2004. So if I'm not long for New Jersey, as you alluded to earlier, there still wasn't really remote arrangements back then.
Right.
So if I'm not long for New Jersey, that means I'm probably not long for Withum,
right,
or so I thought. And so I have to continue to invest in myself and build this skill set, because it sounds like I'm going to be interviewing again soon.
Right, right.
And so, you know, Withum would give me a project to research and it would take me an hour to get to the answer, but then I might spend another 3 hours studying, okay, well, what would the answer have been if the facts had been this instead of that? Or if it had been 10 years ago when the question was asked? And, you know, that's when I started putting away, you know, Sports Illustrated and reading Bicker and Eustace instead, you know? And it wasn't fun, but it was an investment in myself, because I thought I was buying myself freedom. If we wanted to move, you know, my new wife and I, if we wanted to try something different, I could have substance that went somewhere else. And so that my first 2 years at Withum were really defined by that, by really investing in myself above and beyond what I was getting, you know, in work hours. It was understanding that if I really wanted to continue to work towards my goal, which was to be the knowledge base that my professors had, that it wasn't going to be spoon-fed to me,
you know?
Mm-hmm. And so I just read and read and studied and studied, but none of that could overtake the fact that I was very unhappy being back in New Jersey after I'd gotten a taste of the life that I love so much, you know, because, you know, accounting, you know, this as well as anybody, it's a hard life. We work a lot of hours. And if the things that truly, you know, you're truly passionate about aren't accessible when you're not working, it can just break your spirit. And that's what happened to me. In those 2 years, I had a broken spirit because I was putting in all the same hours that I had put in at PW, but now, you know, the things I loved weren't there for the taking. And so we decided after 2 years that we were going to take a chance. And it's a long story I won't bore you with, but my wife was the least likely human being to ever move away from New Jersey. Like, her whole family was there. No one had ever left. Big extended family. But she had visited Aspen with me on just, it's a, like I said, just this trip that we went on out of nowhere. And she just said to me when we were talking about moving, like, hey, that little ski town we went to, like, that's somewhere where I think I could live for a little while because it felt safe and a sense of community and it was beautiful to look at.
And you thought, I was like, yes.
I was like, I could certainly do that. But the irony was she got a job right away, you know, at the school. She's a teacher. Mm-hmm. And Aspen School District hired her right away. So now it was up to me. Yeah. And once again, I was about to commit career suicide because there's no big firms in Aspen, you know. And two guys who turned out to be some of my best friends in the world, you know, they were sole proprietors. And my wife found that they had an ad in like the Chamber of Commerce listing or something. And I reached out to them and they flew us out there for an interview and they were so nice and they hired me. And I went back and I gave my notice at Witham. And Witham said what I expected them to say, which is, it's been real. Thank you. You know, good job. And maybe our paths will cross again someday. And then 2 days later, I got a phone call. And they had had a management committee meeting at Witham. And they said, wait a minute, this is silly. Like, what you do for us is very unique. You know, you're a technical resource. We throw you on conference calls with all our biggest clients. You go head to head with the big four. You know, you study and write opinion letters and you know, memos, whatever it may be, and PLR requests. Why can't you do all that stuff from Aspen? Mm-hmm. And I was like, I could, you know? And we're like, well, let's try this. And, you know, so sad because I had to go back to the two guys who opened the door for me and say, hey, look, thank you, but I'm going to stay with my firm because it just makes sense. Because if we get out there and my wife hates it, well, we just come home and nothing changes, you know? Yeah. And they ended up, like I said, I ended up sharing office space with those two guys for years. I gave them tons of, you know, consulting advice. I feel like it's all worked out in the end. And they're some of my best friends now, but that's how it happened. And so 2006, did it again, packed up and moved to Colorado. And at that point, I was just a manager at Witham, but my career just took off after that because... and you know, I'm not in any way trying to disparage the industry, but the reality is when you work remotely, you are measured solely on your productivity. Mm-hmm. And the reason I bring that up, Bill, is I think I've made clear to you, like, I'm a guy with, I have a lot of passions, you know, and those passions are outside of work a lot of times, you know, and when I was in New Jersey and I was still pursuing those passions at that time in my life, I was into Ironman triathlon and it's time consuming. And, you know, I come in late some mornings after a long run, or I'd leave earlier in tax season to go to master swimming. And, you know, I would get reviews that said, like, you know, smart guy, knows his stuff, but I don't know if he's really committed or not a team player. And that was hard for me to swallow because I felt as committed as anybody. It's just, I wanted a life,
right,
you know?
Right.
But then I go to Aspen, where you would think my firm's worst fears would come true, right? Because if I wasn't committed in New Jersey, now you're letting me off the leash.
Yeah.
What's going to happen? But the exact opposite happened. I will never forget this. I got a review comment my first year in Aspen that said, what a difference 2,000 miles makes. Like, you know, the perfect employee now. And it's like, no, I'm the same employee.
You weren't doing anything different.
Yeah,
it was just...
You can't see, my flexibility now. All you care about is... that I'm there for your clients, that I'm getting the job done, that I'm continuing to grow myself, that I'm adding value to the firm and to our clients. And boy, I mean, that's when everything just clicked, because for the first time, really the first time in my career, everything was in place. Professionally, I was happy. Personally, I was ecstatic. And, you know, for 2006, 2007, you're just like, this is it. I am living my daydream. You know, and that's a pretty cool feeling that everybody should get to have at some point in their life.
Right.
And some people may not get it until they retire, and some people may be smart enough to get it when they're 22 or even younger. But for me, 31, 32 years old, I was just like, everything fell into place. You know, I made partner with them, and things were just going so well. And then, you know, so I'm still into super endurance sports, and at 33, So 2 years after I got out there, I just made partner. Everything's going fantastic. We're thinking about starting a family. And I'm doing this 24-hour ski mountaineering race where you just spend 24 hours climbing up the ski resort and skiing down, climbing up, skiing down, wow, as many times as you can, right? Uh-huh. February. And a couple of days later, I get the first migraine of my life. Like, I've never had a migraine, and I get this blinding migraine that lays me out. But of course, anybody you tell that to is going to say, well, of course, you idiot. You just worked out for 24 hours straight. Yeah. You probably just depleted some chemical or uh-huh. electrolyte or uh-huh. something. So everybody just blew it off. And then I did another race, and the pain was so bad, it sent me to the ER.
Oh, wow.
They did a CAT scan, didn't see anything.
Mm-hmm.
So they, you know, released me into the wild, and I kept pushing myself physically. And every time I would exert myself, I would get this blinding, crippling headache. I mean, to the point where they were pumping morphine into me, into the ER, and it did nothing.
No,
you know?
Kidding.
And so, you know, my wife and I are sitting around, we're like, this doesn't sound right. Like, they had done the CAT scan, it was fine. They had done an MRI on my brain and neck, and that was fine. And so they told me, like, you just have migraines, deal with it, you know? And we started Googling, and we found out, like, there's three tests you should do if you have kind of a worst and first headache, an MRI, a CAT scan, and then something called an MRA. And so we called up, and we're like, let's do this MRA. And they were like, you can do it if you want, but 99% chance it's going to be fine because the other two are fine. Mm-hmm. And I think statistically they were probably correct. But they did the test and found out that I had a 5-millimeter aneurysm in my brain that was like on its last legs, you know? And so this was like earth-shattering, mm-hmm. right? Because I just assumed it was a death sentence because everyone's got an aneurysm story, you know, a roommate's cousin or, you know, an aunt and uncle, and they never end well.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I just got so lucky that this thing was so, when they went in and looked at it on an angiogram. So what we did is we immediately drove back to Philadelphia so that I could recover around my family. We went to Thomas Jefferson there and they did this angiogram where they look at the aneurysm in 3D and it just, an aneurysm, by definition, is a weakness in an artery that balloons out like a cherry on a stem.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is if it pops, blood gets into the brain, 70% of people are dead by the next morning. Mm-hmm. And of the other 30%, as my surgeon put it, half of them will wish they were,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you're just disabled for life. And yeah. My cherry on the stem had formed a second dome on top, and they could watch the blood pulse through it. And so those headaches I was getting were very rare in the medical community. They're called sentinel headaches. And they're warnings that little droplets of blood are slipping out into the, you know, the cranial cavity. And they're very rare. And when they do happen, the average time between one of these warning headaches and a full rupture is about 11 days.
Oh, geez.
And I got my warning sign at the end of February, and they didn't discover the aneurysm until April 26th. So this little dome held on through some of the hardest races in America, and why it didn't just explode, I will never understand.
And tax season.
Yeah, and tax season, right. And so, yeah, everyone else is relaxing because tax season's over. I ship myself back to New Jersey, May 9th, go to Philadelphia. And again, they did the angiogram. And as crazy as this sounds, like an aneurysm, while it's a medical emergency, you're not going to jump to the front of the line surgery-wise unless it's like currently bleeding, like you're in a rupture.
Uh-huh.
And so I went to the hospital just thinking I was getting an angiogram and then we'd schedule surgeries for some later date. But when they saw how thin the aneurysm was, that was it. I never left the hospital.
Yeah.
They said, we're clearing our schedule. We're doing it tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
So 9 hours of brain surgery the next day
to
clip the aneurysm shut. And, you know, I was laying on the table that morning. They were about to wheel me in. And it's interesting the stuff you think about because I thought I might think about how, you know, I moved away from my family for pretty much the last decade. And, you know, if I don't make it out of the surgery, and there was, you know, 5-10% chance I wouldn't make it out, much greater chance that I would make it out but not be the same person.
Mm-hmm.
But I just remember, you know, thinking, should I be regretting the fact that I didn't spend more time around my family? And instead, what I kept thinking, the overwhelming thought was, you know what? If this is the end for me, I'm really proud that I made the decisions necessary to get a taste of my dream life.
Mm-hmm.
Like that I didn't just say, I'll do it when I'm old, I'll do it when I'm retired. Mm-hmm. That I made the hard decisions to move to Colorado, not once, but twice, and to pursue what I wanted in my career because I at least got I at least got to say that my last 2 years, if this is the end of me, I live life on my terms, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And that was really a powerful moment for me because what they say is true. You know, I wasn't on my proverbial deathbed, but it was too close for comfort. And while I was there, I wasn't, you know, regretting the things I had done. You know, I was thinking more about things I hadn't done that I would have liked to have done. So I just got lucky. Others don't. I got lucky. There's no other explanation for it. I had a great surgeon. You know, they repaired the aneurysm, and I have returned to a life that is 100% not only, you know, as active physically and cognitively as it was before, but even more so. But the thing that came out of that experience was, as I said, you regret the things you didn't do. And so now I'm in Aspen, and I'm healing up, and I'm taking inventory of my life and saying, you know, I'm a tax guy. And I'm pretty good at being a tax guy. I know the law pretty well. But what's eating away at me is, you know, you asked me how I became an accountant. And I told you the only thing I was passionate about growing up was writing, you know. I thought, I'd really like to know if I have any talent at that. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not J.R.R. Tolkien, right? I'm not going to create a new universe and write, you know, fiction. But, like, I'm a tax guy. And they say, write what you know. Why can't I get published in the tax world? Mm-hmm. And so I didn't tell anybody at my firm I was going to try it because if I failed, I didn't want anybody to know. But just started submitting article ideas to the tax advisor. And they kept getting turned down because they had already, you know, either handled that topic or they weren't interested in it. And then finally they accepted one. And I was happy until I realized, now I have to actually write this thing. And so like I tend to do, I got obsessed and really poured over. You know, it was about S-Corp reasonable comp. And I poured over every case that had ever been settled on the topic, and I wrote and I rewrote and I wrote and I rewrote, and it got published. And my firm was proud of me, but it wasn't going to change the course of my career. Mm-hmm. You know, I just got published and it was no big deal. But then this weird thing happened a couple months later where it won the Advisor's Article of the Year award. Wow. And, you know, it's not the Heisman or anything, but it's exciting because for my firm, they're like, wait a minute, like, a lot of the people that write for this magazine are professors and big four national tax guys. And here's our, you know, Tony at a regional firm, first thing he's ever published, it wins this award. Like maybe he's got a talent for this. Mm-hmm. And so I give them a lot of credit. The people with him, they said, you know, let's see what more we can do with this. But the reality is in our industry, nobody's going to get excited about anything like that unless you can monetize it.
Yeah.
And what happened is CCH knocked on our door. And they wanted me to contribute to a consolidated return treatise. And there is nothing I'd be less excited to write about than consolidated returns. But I've always believed that, like, you can't just accept the challenges that you know you're going to accomplish. You know what I mean? Like, if you're gonna do it, do it. Like, take on the challenges. And so I took it on, took several months of my life, you know, on top of my normal work duties. But the firm got paid very well for it. And so, you know, they encouraged me to do it. You know, from there, it just spawned more writing opportunities and more writing opportunities. And then the firm launched a tax blog where I was writing informally and assuming nobody was reading it, but at least I was able to kind of have some fun with writing, right? Like develop a voice and be informal. And, you know, you feel like you're screaming into the void sometimes because you don't think anyone's listening, but the right people were listening. And after a couple months of the firm's blog, I got a call from the Janet Novak, the chief editor at Forbes, and they said, would you move your platform over to Forbes? And of course, my firm was like, oh, so we can go from an audience of 500 a month to 5 million a month? Like, where do we sign? Uh-huh. And so all of a sudden, you know, I'm just writing, and this stuff snowballs. You know, people always ask me, well, how do you get started? And I was like, well, just start.
Yeah, right.
Start. Right. Because if you write and you show you have any ability to do it, you're going to get more opportunities than you can imagine. And that's what happened. And we were getting paid for my work. So I was just writing more and more. And then inevitably, if you write, someone will come up to you and say, do you want to teach this stuff?
And as
much as I was passionate about writing, I thought I would hate speaking.
No kidding.
Hate it. And so CCH was the first company that asked me to teach at their user conference. And I said, look, I'm an introvert. Like, there's a reason I chose tax. Uh-huh. Right? I want to deal with other human beings as little as possible. So I do not like the idea of standing in front of a big room and talking about stuff. But again, I thought, what's the worst that can happen? Mm-hmm. If I hate it, then I'm right. And I just go back to hating it.
Right.
But what if I like it? What if I'm good at it? And so I went in and I taught a couple hours at a conference, and I'll never forget, that was the next seminal moment in my career where I walked out of there and just said, I've now moved the goalposts on what I need in my career because mm-hmm. I have to do this. Mm-hmm. I just loved how the whole idea of writing is to communicate an idea, but it's tricky to do in writing, right? Because you got to trust that whoever's reading it has no follow-up questions. They get everything. But mm-hmm. in teaching, you can really make that connection and make mm-hmm. an impact. And so from that day, I was hooked. And nothing snowballs. You know this as well as anybody. Nothing snowballs like teaching. Every time you teach, it's an audition for everybody that's in the room.
Yeah.
And inevitably, somebody, if you do a good job, they invite you to teach at their state society or their firm mm-hmm. or whatever. And so in the span of the last 6 years, I've gone from teaching once a year to now teaching 60, 70 days a year.
It's amazing.
Yeah,
it's, you know, who was it? Seth Godin. I don't know if you read
yeah,
his stuff,
sure,
but
yeah.
he I'd never forget, he wrote a video and didn't have to do with teaching necessarily, but it applies. It had to do with writing actually, yep. about blogging. And he said, look, you know, if just do it. He said, if you're good at it, some people are going to read it. And if you're not good at it, and you keep doing it, you get good at it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's, you know.
Also, I mean, in the tax world, you know, there's some truth, right, to the stereotype that, again, we tend to be more socially introverted, and I'm living proof of that, mm-hmm. you know. If you're willing to stand in front of a room and teach on a topic, I mean, you will never, you know, be out of work. And, you know, that's my career has been proof of that because I've been learning as I've gone, both with writing and teaching. And the reality is I'm at a point where there's, especially with the new law, the new tax law, there's almost more opportunity than you can keep up with.
Oh, God,
you
know? Yeah. And it's like the gift that keeps on giving.
It is the gift that keeps on giving. But I never, ever thought I would like speaking. I'm always terrified in anticipation of it. But we all in our careers want to find our highest and best use. Mm. And as begrudgingly as I say this, I think teaching the tax law is my highest and best use because it forces me to know the material. I can make an impact on our industry at large by helping other practitioners understand it. But then, of course, I now own the material that I can then turn around and help my client base mm-hmm, with, you mm-hmm. know, and help my firm with. And so that is the gift that keeps on giving because... Man. Again, it's not just the value that I can give to my clients. I really do enjoy the aspect of coming to something like this, you know, AICPA conference, and I teach at a lot of their conferences now. And there's nothing better than someone coming up to you after a class and say, that topic, whatever it might be, escort distributions or who knows, like just say, for 20 years, I've tried to make sense of it and I couldn't make sense of it. And now I think I get it because uh-huh. the way you presented it, like that's the most gratification you can get, you know? And so... Yeah. I'm just in a great place now because I get to do things that selfishly I really am passionate about, which is try to be those professors that I was so jealous right. of, stand right. in front of a room and give case law and talk about a career coming full circle. But starting in September, I'm actually going to be an adjunct professor at University of Denver grad tax program, teaching with my heroes, you know?
That's awesome.
It's one of those things where they pay you for it, but I think I would pay them to do it because it's just such, you know, it's literally like the culmination of a career-long dream. But it was not, as you just heard, it was not a straightforward path.
No, not at all. So, I mean, just to put a kind of a quick bow on it, you're at Reuben Brown now.
I am.
So I moved. Where did that come?
So it's because, again, I think you never, ever stop taking inventory of your career and your professional life and saying, am I maximizing, you know, everything? Mm-hmm. And I'm a father of two children now, you know, a 10-year-old and a 7-year-old. And I loved my time at Witham. The firm was beyond great to me. But the reality is, in the time I was at Witham, it went from a 600-person firm to a 1,200-person firm while I was across the country. And as the firm continued to grow, you feel less and less connected, you know, because there's so much turnover and you go to a partner meeting and I don't recognize half of the room.
Right.
And then the reality was, you know, all of my work-related I do a lot of traveling to teach, mm-hmm. but then I was also doing a ton of traveling back east for Witham type things, you sure. know, whether it's partner meetings or
just having to go back to the mothership, right?
Yeah, but you can't have it all. You can't ask Witham, you just can't say to Witham, please, you know, make me a partner and pay me a partner salary, but I don't want to travel back for the partners meeting. Right. You can't do that. And I just reached a point where I thought, you know, I love Witham, but there's other places that are more close by where I can do what I'm doing, feel plugged in, feel connected, and not spend as much time away from my family. Mm-hmm. And really, that's what it was coming down to, is just, you know, a 3-hour partner meeting at my firm was costing me 3 days away from my kids. And that would be palatable if I didn't also spend another 25 days away from my family teaching at conferences and at firms. And so I started to look around and say, is there another fit? You know, is there another fit where I really feel at home? And I landed on Reuben Brown and just quickly kind of fell in love with the leadership there and said, hey, you know, going to St. Louis and Chicago and Denver is a lot easier than Orlando, Boston, and New Jersey. Yeah, yeah. And so it was not an easy decision. I mean, I was an equity partner at Witham, and I thought I was going to end my career there. But 2 little kids and enough people telling me, before you know it, you're going to blink and they're going to be in college. It just made me say, whatever I can do to maximize the time with the kids, then that's what I'm going to do. And so I've been at Reuben Brown since January now, and you know, nothing that's happened in my 6 months there has told me that I made a bad decision. Yeah. They're both fantastic firms, but it just was a time in my life to say, as I've done continuously for the last 20 years, say, if everything's not ideal, how can I make it a little more ideal?
Right. Yeah. So I think this is kind of like my last question here, because I can see where all this is leading. What kind of advice would you give someone coming straight out of school, about ready to start their career? I mean, from everything that you've learned about yourself and what this job looks like, what would you tell someone? What kind of advice would you give them?
It's really interesting, Bill, that you're saying that, because honestly, on my way up here to meet with you, a young guy right out of school stopped me out by the pool and said, I'm sorry, I got to pick your brain for a minute. And this is what he asked me, you know? So if I sound well rehearsed, it's because I am. But I would give anybody starting their career, or even a couple years into their career, more than a couple, I mean, at any point in your career, I'd give you 3 pieces of advice. And again, these are only things I gleaned from my own career. But number one piece of advice is to invest in yourself, right? To understand that if you think it's the job of your mentor or your coach or your partners to handhold you to get you wherever you want to be in your career, it's just not reality. It might sound good on a brochure, but like, they have their own lives. And if you want to learn personal financial planning, or if you want to become a tax expert, you're not getting that in your 9-to-5. And I know we don't have a 9-to-5, but you get what I mean.
Sure.
And you know, it does mean that you got to make some hard choices. You've got to, you know, put away People magazine and read, you know, a BNA portfolio, and you've got to read tax court cases every day to learn this stuff, but you're getting something in return. That's why it's called an investment, right? Mm-hmm. What you're getting in return is substance, so that if life throws you a curveball, if your firm goes away like Anderson did, or if you meet a guy or girl clear across the country and you want to go move somewhere else, you can walk into an interview and know that you can add value. Mm. And so investing in yourself is tricky, because I talk to people all the time, young people who reach out to me on LinkedIn or whatever and say, I'm at a firm, I'm doing well, but it doesn't feel like they care about my growth. They just care about making their jobs easier. I'm interested in writing. They never want me writing. I'm interested in seeing other sides of the tax law. They just want me to keep doing what I do every year. Mm-hmm. And I say to them, look, this is going to be hard to hear, but you're not getting what you need. You got to move on. You got to go somewhere else that'll give you what you need. Or you got to do what you need to do outside of work, like I did getting a master's in tax or reading, mm-hmm. so that you can then leave your firm to someone that will treat you better. Because right. like I said, people get the misguided notion that, you know, that somebody at their firm is going to take an interest in them and guide them directly where they need to be. And that is very rare.
Yeah, it doesn't happen.
You got to put in the work. Yep. So number one is it's a constant investment in yourself. And no one said it's going to be easy, but that's why you can have a special career if you do it.
Yeah.
Number two, and it sounds super cliche, but I've lived it. So, you know, understanding that life's short, you know, and you know, I learned that lesson the hard way. But the point is, if you have things in your life that are non-negotiable, you know, for me, it was living in the mountains and skiing and mountain biking, that sort of thing. Like, you know, you could wait. You could wait until you're 65 and retire and move to a mountain town if that's the thing that, you know, sparks your fire. But really would tend to resist that because none of us are promised tomorrow. So if you're lucky enough to have things you're truly passionate about that are non-negotiable, you know, I wouldn't wait to pursue them. And every time I've pursued them, life has rewarded me for those decisions. You know?
I forget where I read it somewhere, but I mean, I've seen it multiple times, survey after survey done of elderly people who are close to the end, and they ask them, you know, what they're feeling. And the biggest emotion usually is some form of regret for not having done something that they should have done.
And so, I just had that accelerated to 33, right? Because that's when I got laid on the metal table and wheeled into a brain surgery I didn't know if I was going to come out of.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, that's served me well. It really has. And then the third piece of advice, and this I am a huge proponent of, is say yes to opportunity, right? Like, leave no stone unturned, not just in your career, in your life. If you think, you know, you'd like to try writing, right? No one's going to clear your schedule to do it. Just like you said, just start it, try it, right? But outside of life, you always wondered if you could play the guitar, get YouTube and play the guitar, right? Because people always say to me, like, you know, I think when CCH first asked me to teach about my career path, they titled it something like How to Have Your Dream Career. And I made them change it because the notion of a dream career is silly, because if you're doing things right and you're constantly trying new things, you should be constantly moving the goalposts of what your dream career is.
Right.
Right. 10 years ago, the idea of standing in front of a room of a couple hundred people and teaching tax law was miserable to me. And now it is a huge part of my dream career. But if I continue to do things right and take on new challenges, I would like to think that in 5 years, my dream career will be defined differently.
Right.
And so whether it's in your career or just in your life, like, it's so easy to say no to things because they might be a little difficult or they might be a little scary. But then how do you ever find out what you're good at, what you're passionate about, you know? And I am so grateful that when I made partner at a public accounting firm that I didn't just say, well, that's it. You know, that's it. I made partner. I don't need to try things. It was after I made partner that I tried publishing. It was after I made partner that I started teaching. And it's been the most fulfilling years of my career. And so, again, it's not going to be teaching and writing for everybody, but the kid came up to me today and he said, I'm really interested in, you know, adding like wealth advisory and personal financial planning. I'm only 2 years in my career. If you could go back, would you pursue those things? And I said, are you interested in it? And he said, yeah. So there's your answer.
Yeah.
Of course you should pursue it, because worst comes to worst, you hate it.
Right.
But if you love it, you've moved the goalposts on what you need out of your career.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
And so those are the three pieces of advice, you know? And again, I think they've served me well. I would imagine they'd serve a lot of people well. I think they're kind of obvious, but just because they're obvious doesn't mean everyone does it, right?
Right, right. Well, Tony, amazing stuff. Thanks for the conversation.
Thanks. This is awesome. I really appreciate you sitting down and talking with me.
Wow, great stuff there. That was Tony Needy, a partner in Reuben Brown's Tax Services Group. He's also a well-known contributor of tax content to Forbes and a frequent speaker and trainer at seminars and webcasts across the country. Check out his archive of Forbes articles at forbes.com/sites/AnthonyNeedy. That's Needy, N-I-T-T-I. And remember, this week's sponsor is the Business Learning Institute. The BLI's Future Ready Learning Framework outlines the skills that CPAs need to thrive in the rapidly changing world of accounting and finance. That framework is all about gaining and maintaining deep technical knowledge along with a strategic skill set. And we're talking about strategic aptitudes that have been identified as most crucial for tomorrow's CPAs. Start mastering these future-ready skills now by visiting macpa.org/future-learning. That's all I got this week, gang. Have a great week.